Welcome back, everybody, to another quarantine edition of an Investor's Journey podcast. This is our special segment of Tips from the Pros. And I'm very excited today because we have one of the most amazing couples that I've met in this industry. Very genuine, very honest with everything that they do. They stuck it out since they started. It's been amazing to see the growth. We've been growing alongside them, just seeing everything. So we're very happy to have them on and to share their knowledge with us and their experience on growing their business. So with that being said, I would love to introduce you guys to Veronica and Will Pritchett. So welcome, guys, to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be
super
here.
Super excited.
Very glad to have you guys on. So I wanted to kind of get started, just jump off a little bit with the real estate space. What made you guys want to get started in real estate, and whose idea was it first? Was it Veronica or Will? Who decided to do this first?
Oh, it was all my idea.
No, it was my idea. She's just no. She's done all the hard work.
No, it was definitely Will's idea.
Yeah, I had seen too many people that were successful in real estate over long periods of time, and I think that's where I thought about buy and hold, as I saw these people that own property and years later it was worth so much, or they had sold property and they were like, man, I wish I still had that piece of property that I had years ago. And so I was really interested, but I, as a young guy, single guy, bought my first house and I asked the realtor, I was like, hey, I'd like to get into buy and hold, like rental property. He goes, oh, you can't make any money. And I let him talk me out of it. I just assumed he was an expert in investing, but he was, you know, he was a sales guy, so he didn't really have experience in investing. So I stuck with the reading of the books and dreaming about it. And then probably a good 10 years later, we got our first rental property after we were married, and the rest is history.
Wow, that's very cool.
Yeah.
And did you do any type of education or training or anything before you got started, or did you just like kind of jump in and figure it out? How did you get going?
I think books primarily starting out, and then as podcasts started to come out and become popular, we just consumed a lot of podcasts. And then Alamoria.
Yeah. So Will, he's been interested in this for a long time. So he was reading a lot and listening to podcasts. And so I wasn't 100% convinced that our first rental was the house we were living in. It was Will's bachelor pad and we got married, and then we wanted to buy our house together. And so once we were moving, he had a lot of equity in that house. Of course, I thought, well, let's sell it, right? We could really use that equity. And he was like, he had this vision, you know, that he really wanted to keep it as a rental. So then the way he convinced me was it could pay for Nathan's college. So that's how we thought, okay, so we could make, so then it occurred to me, okay, we can make $300 a month. Somebody can pay us $300 a month. So that could go towards college savings. And this house will be paid off by the time Nathan graduates from high school. So that's our college savings. So instead of having to pay each month towards the college savings, we were now going to make $300 a month and this house would be paid off. So that's when what convinced me. And then it worked after that. But meanwhile, Will is reading and podcasts and then Alamoria. And then after a while, I'm just like, okay, let's just do this already. So then that's when we jumped in and joined Alamoria and started networking and meeting a lot of people.
Wow, very cool. And so you talk about your kids. How many kids do you guys have?
We have two, a 13-year-old boy and an 8-year-old girl, and they've seen more nasty houses than they'd care to recall. But we're hoping they learn something along this this journey.
You want them to follow in your footsteps?
Yeah, I think it's starting to rub off. Our 13-year-old, well, he turned 13 in March, and then he said, okay, so with all of his birthday money, he said, Mom, so I have $100 worth of birthday money. So if I were to invest it in the business, how much could I make a month? Okay, so we earn a high interest rate, and we drew up a note. We both signed it, and now he makes $10 a month every month for his $100. So
wow.
He's starting to catch on.
That's a hell of a return. I want to invest with you guys. 10% a month. Yeah. I think we're going to put our money with you guys too. That is awesome though. But teaching them the concept of investing and all that, I tell my wife the same thing. I was like, my kid is going to be one of those little hustlers in school. Like, I'm going to teach him how to borrow money from one kid and lend it to another one at interest rate. Like, you know, he's going to learn about business. Well, that's cool.
I don't think we teach kids in schools about finance, you know, and investing. And I think of all the things, if we had known this 10 years or 15 years earlier, how much farther along we would be, because time's really on your side. So we just want to hopefully teach them a little bit more about, you know, money, so they can be on their own financial footing, starting out their lives.
We're getting you some private money. John Barr says he has $100 right now too. So we got you. Everybody's gonna want to invest with you guys now. So you've been doing all of this in San Antonio, or did you guys live somewhere else before?
All here in San Antonio. Yeah, we got married. In 2 days, I guess it'll be 9 years, our anniversary, and we became investors 2 days after our wedding. We moved out of that bachelor pad into our new house, and that was for rental number one. We had no idea what we were doing, signed the lease, and then followed the lady to her house to make copies on her copy machine, because we didn't have copies of the lease.
Yeah.
Completely unprofessional, but we learned, and we did it better the next time.
And how many years ago was this?
We started 9 years ago, almost exactly 9 years ago, with our very first rental. And we had that one for a few years before we did another. And it was a slow start. And then it built, you know, momentum as, for one, that Veronica was able to start full time and she quit her job. That gave her a lot of time and energy to put towards the business. And then learning some new techniques and learning about private money, you know, things picked up dramatically after several years into it. So I would say most of that growth has been in the last 4 years.
Yeah, from 2014 to, I guess that's when we bought our second, and then 15. From 15 on, it's really, once we learned about the BRRRR strategy and how to use, and then just going to a lot of networking events, and then just the power of private money, that's when our business really began to grow.
Very nice. So you guys first started, you were both employed, right? When you invested, you did your first couple investments?
Yeah.
And what did you guys do?
Yeah, we were both full-time.
So I was a high school assistant principal. So I helped open two large comprehensive high schools in Northside. I helped open Stevens High School. I helped open Brennan High School. And so I worked a lot of hours with extracurricular. You know, I had to go to all the extracurricular events. So I was working a ton of hours. And then Will has been firefighter and is promoted, several times. So we were both working quite a bit.
And what made you want to?
And then he also, we didn't know.
Go ahead.
Sorry. So when we started, we didn't know all these other creative ways of financing. So we thought we needed to put 20% down, which we did for our first two houses. So he was working a lot of overtime, you know, trying to save up that money. And we were really just putting everything into savings and trying to save for that 20% down until we, as we were, learning about this investing and how to grow faster.
Very nice. So what made you want to go full time? At what point did you guys decide? Did you guys have already a couple properties in the portfolio and you're like, hey, this is a real thing, we really like this? Or like, how did that transition go?
So it's kind of a combination of things. I started to grow. I guess I had maybe six rentals at the time. And so it kind of, and then we had Elena, our second, child was born, and so life just got really crazy. So I was working, I don't know, a ton of, let's say 80 hours a week sometimes. Like, it was a lot of work, and then managing the rentals, and then I just realized while I loved my job, it was just really, it didn't allow for the flexibility that I wanted to be with the kids. So it was to the point where we're gonna have to hire property management to get some help, and then it was like, well, I could do this. I could, you know, manage our properties and then grow our business, and that allows me the flexibility to be there for the kids. And thank God it worked, you know. So it was walk away with less income, but thankfully we had been frugal the whole time and living off of Will's income. We're investing all of my income, I guess you could see it that way, but at that point. But so instead of hiring property management, we decided that I could do that, and then also just at the same time just really focus on growing our business. So that's what we did, and it worked out, thankfully.
Yes.
Never looked back.
Very cool. And out of all the strategies, why buy and hold? I mean, there are so many things. I always, you know, everybody I speak to, like, you have people that swear by fix and flips and owner finance and everything. What made you want to just do the buy and hold? What caught your attention on that?
And I think there's so many things about it. And we were talking about this today before this interview, is that there, you can be successful in really any niche. There's not a right niche. We went to a big multifamily seminar in Colorado this winter, and it was great, you know, and that's a great strategy for some people. But what we really liked about buy and hold is we've always wanted to build a lifestyle business. We wanted it to be a business that we could turn off if we want to travel. We really like to travel, and we really value our time together as a family. So we can literally turn it off. We don't have employees, and we can just leave for 2 months and then come back to it and turn it back on. The management's become, Veronica has great systems so that it's manageable while we're away. And so that's great. The Burr method particularly, we found that we could build our net worth. So we were actually after cash flow because we knew we needed cash flow to sustain and to grow. But what we built more than cash flow was net worth, because if you do a Burr strategy, you're building, say, 25% equity into each and every property. So instead of flipping them and taking the profit now, which we do a few flips a year, a couple maybe, but why we like the buy and holds is that equity is still ours. We don't get the big paycheck, but we get that cash flow over the years. And so we saw that our net worth grew quicker than our cash flow did, probably. So now we're at a point where we can use that net worth and convert it if we want to sell something, or if we need to, you know, we can sell it later and it could be kind of like a slow flip, or we could owner finance it. It just gives you options to have that net worth build. But, you know, all the other things, the leverage, I think, you know, in buy and hold with 30-year fixed mortgages, you just can't find that in any other asset class. You can't find it in commercial. You can't find such good terms on any other loans that I'm aware of. A friend of mine just bought a house at 3.something% investment property. I mean, that's unreal for a 30-year fix. So the debt that's available for buy and hold is unbelievable. I personally think in San Antonio, real estate's great. If you can afford to buy it cash, you'll get a nice return. But what really magnifies the return is the use of leverage. So without getting too deep into that, the use of that, you know, that great 30-year debt is what amplifies the rate of return. Of course, the appreciation, San Antonio is kind of a nice and steady market, so we don't get this huge swings in appreciation, but we don't typically have the big drops in value either. So it's a nice, predictable market. So if you're getting some appreciation in prices and then you're getting some debt pay down by someone else, those two alone are building your net worth. Plus you get some cash flow, and then the tax benefits are unreal. The depreciation, we met with our CPA today, and we literally are at a point where we need to tell them, don't write off as much because no one will lend to us. So by owning these properties, our net worth is growing, and it looks as though we make less money, and that is unreal to me. It's still like magic. And so, yeah, there's so many reasons, but those are a few.
It's hilarious because with John, we talked about it with our accountant too last year, and it was like to a point where like we realized we can't keep writing off because of the same thing. Like they won't lend to you because they're to them it's like, you know, you don't make any money, and it's like, no, we do make money. It's just you know, a lot of it comes passively. So you have so many advantages, and you got to learn how to play the field a little bit so you can get it. It's kind of crazy, right? The fact that you can make money, banks don't like that. They want you to pay taxes in order for them to lend to you.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's been eye-opening.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, and it's having that good relationship. It's having that good relationship with your lender and your CPA, because we rely on both of them. Like, okay, where do we need to be so we can keep growing? And it's having those conversations multiple times a year to make sure that we stay keep that balance.
Yeah, that's a really good tip right there, of having a conversation with your CPA multiple times a year, because it's not just when tax time comes around. You need to prepare for that the year before to understand, like, how's this year going to look? Because if not, for businesses like ours, it will get to a point, you know, that like kind of this year that we keep pushing it, but our tax bill is going to be way up there this year, right? And it's something that you need to understand, you need to prepare for, because if not, like, it's a lot of money that you got to shovel out, you know, and you got to figure out, do I want to pay it? Do I want other write-offs? So that's a great tip to keep doing that. So let's get into the nitty gritty of buying rentals. How do you pick the rentals that you're going to buy before you even start looking? Like, what is your target when you're buying rentals, right? Like, what markets, neighborhoods, price points, what do you target?
That's a really good question. So we love the working class neighborhoods. And I think, so the goal, the main objective in all of this is to keep the business as passive as possible. And the number one thing, in my opinion, is buying the right property. If you buy the right property, you're going to attract the right tenant, or the tenant that's going to make this property as passive as possible. So it's kind of a balance, right? Because you can go into your C minus neighborhoods, but it might be a little bit more management intensive. But your cash flow is going to be better, right? Or you can go into your B plus, and then maybe it's a little less management intensive, but maybe it's more appreciation gain and less cash flow. So it's that constant balance. So we have a good anywhere from like a C plus to a B plus neighborhoods. We're looking for that good solid working class neighborhood where, for whatever reason, they're probably going to be renters for life, you know, and they're great families. They're good, hardworking people, and they take good care of the house. But it's some of the nitty gritty criteria. We won't buy anything bigger than 1800 square feet, not for rental. If it's bigger than 1800 square feet, it's probably going to be a flip. And that's mainly to keep capital expenditures down. Because anything bigger than that, it's going to be more paint, more floor, more everything, bigger AC, whatever it may be. so that's a big one. And then we don't like to go too old, because, you know, it's keeping that capital expenditures down as much as possible when we're selecting the property. And we always want a cash flow, a minimum of $300 a month, gross cash flow. That's after PITI. We want a minimum of $300 a month to be able to, you know, cover any expenses or, you know, whatever, to keep the business growing. What else? What am I leaving out?
We prefer single story homes. You know, we started investing on the northwest side of town. That's the area we were comfortable with and familiar with. And then we gradually started to look in other areas. We looked in, you know, closer to to downtown, and then we've even moved to the south side. So we don't have one particular area, but they all are very similar in the type of people that live in them. They're working people. They're people that have jobs. A lot of them are, you know, service industry or something like that, but they're great people. You know, I was thinking about the other day, I think most of our houses have one car garages or carports. So someone had asked me a question about rentals. Is it a big deal if it doesn't have a two-car garage? And I thought, gosh, I think we've only got maybe two houses with two-car garages. So they're smaller houses. You know, you'll see a lot of plumber's trucks and things like that in the driveways. But it's hard to classify neighborhoods on the ABC scale. It's somewhat subjective. But they're not war zones by any means. And then the individual properties we have are all to a quality that we would be proud to live in. Mm-hmm. We'd be proud for you to see it and know that we owned it. It's not the type of house that, you know, we heard all these stories about, oh, my uncle's sister's brother had a rental and they were a nightmare and they put holes in the wall. And come to find out, they were slumlords. They didn't take care of the property. So, of course, you only attract questionable people. If you provide a good product, like in any business, you can attract a good client, a good customer. And that's what our tenants are. So our houses, whatever neighborhood they're in, are going to be in really great shape, safe, comfortable, climate controlled, and we're fast to repair things. So it keeps going back to that relationship with the tenants. Again, once that ARV, though, gets above about 160,000, that tends to be where we start topping out, where our taxes, our property taxes, are outrunning our rents a lot of times. And we're kind of assessing one property right now that we may offload because the taxes keep going up, but the rents aren't. And so we might take that capital and move it into a couple of lower priced rentals, to get a better ROI. So constantly kind of evaluating the portfolio and trying to maximize where your equity is.
That makes sense. And now, as far as, so John, if he's still watching, he can correct me. I think the medium rent in San Antonio is like $1,425, something like that. So do you try to stay around that? Like, what is your bottom rent that you're like, you know, we really don't want to rent below this price point because of the types of people, or above this price point because of the market? Like, is there an area you like to stick between?
Yeah, that's a good point. So we actually have a 2-1. It's a back unit apartment. So that one's $750 a month. But then we have all the way up to $1,450. Most of them are in the $1,200 range. and that, what I have found, we actually did, we bought a house. We thought it was going to make a great rental. I ran comps. That house was supposed to rent for like $1,400 or $1,500 or $1,600, I don't know, some amount. And what I realized was that the tenant pool shrunk at that price point. So I have a lot more people to choose from in the $1,200, $1,300 range, and I want more people to apply, and that way I can be a little bit more selective. So that's the range that we like, that most of our houses are in, and most of them work. And then there's less mobility too, because we had a higher end rental, and it was great people moved there, lived in it, but they moved out every year because it was a transitional house for them. They were going to buy a house. They weren't going to be renters for life. And we kind of like the people that, you know, are fine being renters for life. So we have found that that's more in the 12th in San Antonio. It's more in the $1,200 or give or take range.
Yeah. I always love asking that question because I have people that, they love rentals, but they won't go above $1,200 in San Antonio. Like, they want to stay mm-hmm. under that, you know, $1,100, $1,200. And then other people, they won't go below $1,400. They want those higher end homes. And it's always interesting. Everybody's got their logic and the reasoning behind it. And,
right.
and it's crazy how many times I've spoken to people that actually have decades of experience doing this, right? And that's their logic. And it's like, you know, if it works for you, I guess that's the strategy. But, you know, I always like asking to see where everybody fits. We're in the same realm that you guys are. We see the same things. I mean, everything you guys are saying is, you know, music to my ears, because I'm like, yes, I agree 100%.
Yeah.
So Joel Lutz actually says, Veronica and Will are awesome. So you got some fans.
Joel is awesome.
he is awesome. That's our insurance agent and friend and fellow investor. So he's really great because he has the angle on the best way to do your insurance with. He'll tell us, like, if you do this, your insurance will drop, and just has a real investor's perspective. So he's awesome.
There you guys go. If you need an insurance person, there's Joel. You should reach out. We have a question from Chris Ramirez. She says, what is the best way to evaluate the C+ to B neighborhoods? Best resources to find this out?
I think the classifying neighborhoods is very difficult. I would just say, I mean, just a real layman's way of looking at this is, are there work trucks in the driveways? Are there workers? Are there, you know, cars with business names on the side, you know, blue collar types of people. These are, but they're employed. They're not, you know, they're not on assistance. So they're, you know, in the middle of the day, there might not be that many cars in the driveway because they're all out working. But at the, in the evening, they're going to be service type vehicles. They're going to be families. Not in a high crime area, you know, but it's really hard to classify. In San Antonio, I would say it is those rentals, 1,200 and below, would be like your B and down probably. What do you think?
Yeah, at the beginning, we were really stuck on the school districts, you know, and that's all we knew was northwest side of town, and we knew Northside School District, and that's the only place we were open to invest in, and that was kind of a comfort level, I think. And then as we grew, and then we moved to Northeast, and then we were SCISD, and we love Harlandale, so we found that like the school district wasn't as important in getting the property rented. One rule of thumb for us, not that we do this, we don't go to the door and collect rent, but if we had to go to the door and collect rent, we would feel safe doing it. And that's a matter of opinion. Everyone has a different feeling. But for us, that was kind of, we've gone to some properties, we pull up, we're like, nope, I would not feel comfortable knocking in that on that by myself on that door if I had to. And so that's been for us, you know, not that that's like any stats that I'll show you. That's really a personal thing. Now, I will say I'm very comfortable going just about, you know, anywhere. There's very few places that I don't feel comfortable walking to. But and then, of course, you know, you just want to know your areas, you know, and then and what's really cool about, like, I would say our properties are kind of are in clusters. Like we find one area and it's like, wow, this did really well. So now we buy as many as we can in that area. And it's really great to do that because then you can move faster. Like, you know what it's going to rent for, you know what the property value, you know what it's going to appraise at. And so you can move a lot faster on a property like that. And then we bought properties in areas where we're like, nope, don't want to buy another one in that area. And it was in a Northside school district. And it was just an area that just didn't do well for us. So we just, you know, I think it's going to depend on, I hate that I can't give like solid, if the numbers work, right? Yeah.
It is.
I mean, first, of course, your numbers have to work. That's bottom line. And then after your numbers work, then it's, do I really want to own this property or not?
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, it's a tough question. And at the end of the day, I think you hit the nail on the head where it's like, it's where you're comfortable investing. You know, if the numbers make sense and you're comfortable with the area, by all means. So that actually takes me to one of my last questions in this little segment, which is, when you're finding your rental properties, how much do you value cash flow versus appreciation? Or do you want a little bit of both? I mean, how do you calculate those?
Well, like Veronica said, we look for that cash flow number is a benchmark because we do need cash flow to keep everything afloat. We're not really betting on appreciation. We consider appreciation icing on the cake. You'll hear that a lot in this, you know, buy and hold game. And the good thing in San Antonio, in a solid neighborhood, you're gonna have some appreciation. And you can look at different charts to see that average rate of return. So you're gonna probably, over the long run, get some appreciation. But cash flow is the priority. I will say that what tends to happen in buy and hold is on the lower end houses, you might get more cash flow, but you're probably not gonna get as much appreciation. On the higher end homes, you know, say a $400,000 or $500,000 home, your cash flow might be in the negatives, but you stand to have more appreciation. So it's sort of a trade-off. If you're like a lot of us that don't have a lot of cash starting out, I say go after cash flow and build some equity over time through appreciation and debt pay down. And then you have more options for your next, you know, your next stage of investing. You know, I really like who was it? One of the guys from the RIA that was talking about on the lower end, he likes to owner finance them because he feels like he's not going to miss out on that future appreciation because they're not going to appreciate that much. And it might be a tenant class he doesn't want to manage. So by owner financing, he still gets cash flow, but he doesn't have the tenant headaches and the ongoing maintenance and upkeep. So that was an interesting perspective. I think that was Steve Carlson, actually, that mm-hmm. gave that advice. I thought that was a really good model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a little combination of.
Good. Unfortunately, we have a little delay here. All right. But, can you guys hear me fine?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can still hear you.
So I agree. I mean, it's a good combination. I think it's a really good tip. If you don't have too much money, to go ahead and work on cash flow, because I've heard so many people, and this is a good experience of what's happening right now in the economy, is I've heard so many people, especially in Austin, that they're like, yeah, I'll have negative cash flow, but the appreciation is amazing. And I'm like, but you can't guarantee appreciation. Like you know, you hope for it, but there's no way of guaranteeing it because things change in the market, and then what do you do, right? So I think it's a dangerous game to bet only on appreciation. So I think that was a really good tip. How do you guys find your properties? So do you guys do marketing, or do you buy from wholesalers?
I was hoping you'd ask this question. So I'm going to give you a little plug, John. When we were early on in this, we were coming to Alamo Ria. We didn't know, you know, any of these terms. We felt out of place. And we were asking you the same question. How do you find the deals? And it was really surprising to me how much information you shared with us. And that was what started to build that sense of community there. I thought in a group like that, everyone would be competing. But you shared, you know, all this information. One of the things I remember you talking about was networking, the value and the importance of networking. And we took that to heart and we started going to networking events. And after a while, I started to speak at networking events, even just in conversation, or if they asked for a volunteer, you know, to speak, to let people know what I did. And now more and more people knew what we were doing, what we were looking for. And I really think we have spent probably less than $500 combined across everything in marketing. Really, everything has come through networking. It's come from the people we've met and the people who know somebody who's selling a house, or a wholesaler who's selling a house and was presenting it at a RIA meeting or some sort of networking event, a realtor that we met that knew what we were doing, you know, and so it all comes back to networking. So that has been our pipeline, really, through this whole thing. I think we've only bought one through what you might call direct marketing, through a text messaging campaign, but really networking, it's free, mm-hmm. You know.
I agree, obviously. that's been our biggest strategy for the longest time. We spent no money on marketing at all. And even now that we might start marketing, it's more for testing purposes, not really for marketing's sake. But I agree. And it goes to the point that you get what you put in, right? And that's where I think a lot of people fall short, is that they don't put in as much time like we have in the networking space. And in, like you're saying, you raise your hand and you get up there and you share and you help and you participate, because that's why it is that we've gotten the amount of deal flow. We're always volunteering. We're always helping out. We're always, you know, in people's faces. And it's just, that's why we get deals, right? It's just people know you and they want to work with you. So it's really good to hear that and to know that you guys are doing really good that way. Do you guys have any plans, though, now that the market is shifting a little bit and a lot of wholesalers are kind of falling out? Do you have any plans of maybe starting some marketing up, or you're just keep going the way you are?
We haven't really talked about it. We've made a couple offers since the start of this COVID deal, but we're not seeing any softening in prices yet, that, you know, through wholesalers, the ones that are still sending deals. I think we might revisit that here, but we personally, our theory is that the prices aren't going to soften for a while with all the forbearance and programs to help people, which hopefully they'll help people and they can get back on their feet. But if there is hardship, we don't think it's going to hit people hard until those forbearance and those programs run out, until the time's up and then they have to catch up. So I wouldn't say that we're eager to start investing in a marketing campaign just yet, but maybe at the first of the year, sometime after the 2021, maybe we would start doing that. We have been a long spell without buying anything. And that was, you know, prices were getting so high and it was getting competitive there before COVID hit. And it's been the seller's market for so long. So we're anxious to get another project underway, but we're not going to, we're going to be more conservative now than we've ever been, probably, too, you know, in our offer prices and so forth.
Yeah, and that's a really go ahead.
Did it freeze? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I just wanted to add to everything Will said. I feel like our business is very relationship based. You know, that's something that we both all around. And so I will say that we're fine paying the assignment fee. If the numbers work for our deal, we're perfect. We've paid up to a $20,000 assignment fee, and that was fine because I know that's a lot of work. And we're perfectly fine. So what we are, we still nurture those relationships with wholesalers, you know, the ones that have brought us really good deals that we, whenever they send us a deal, we stop and we look, you know, because they brought us good solid deals. So we still nurture those relationships. So we rely a lot on them. And then just our circle, you know, the last deals we've bought have all been directly from sellers, but it's somebody that said, hey, so-and-so is selling their house. So it's just constantly being present for now. You know, it's just constantly being present, letting people know that we're still here, we're still buying, and we're happy to pay assignment fee, referral fee. You know, so while we don't spend any money on marketing per se, we focus on other things in our business. We're happy to pay that assignment fee or referral fee. So for now, it's nurturing those relationships that we have established throughout this process.
Right. And I think that's a good tip for any wholesalers watching. They are being more conservative. So there's a lot of investors right now in this market. So you got to be more conservative with the deals you get. We're getting a lot of wholesale deals and they're acting like nothing's happened. And it's like, no investors really thinking that same way anymore. You know, we're all being really conservative with our deals. So when you go negotiate, you got to use that in your negotiations if you want anybody to buy your deals. So keep that in mind. So I wanted to talk about the next thing was, how do you analyze your rentals? So you kind of talked a little bit about the areas that you like, the B's and C's and all of that, but how do you actually analyze when you're going to buy a house? Do you look at, you know, hey, let's buy this. We're going to do all the updating up front, so it's all good to go for the next X number of years. Or do you buy it and do just enough to kind of get it rented, and then on rent, tenant turnover, you do it? Like, how do you analyze them? Like, what makes you buy into them?
Do you want to answer that? Well, I mean, I guess it was a lot. As far as analyzing a deal, we've done everything from, you know, a minor rehab to full foundation down to the studs. So it just really goes back to the numbers. But we used a BRRRR strategy. So we refinance. So we buy with private money, right? We use very little money out of our pocket, and then we go and refinance it. So because we do that, we're going to try to rehab the property as much as possible. We're going to put in a new roof, a new AC, new everything, because again, we want it to, of course, if it needs it, if it doesn't need it, you know, if it's going to need it within the next 5 years or whatever, we're going to go ahead and do it, because in the refi, we're going to go ahead and all of that gets financed in. So that's one way to, as long as it's not coming out of our pocket, we're able to maximize our ROI on that piece of property. So it's just kind of so we try to do as much as we possibly can, because then it becomes more passive. And we're able to use, you know, conventional financing, which we, you know, to refinance out of that note. I don't know if I'm answering all of your questions. How into the numbers you want to get.
Yeah. And how do you guys, you analyze to do the full renovation, whatever it needs, like you want to factor that in when you're buying the house, if you see that the AC is old, you're making sure that, you know, that's accounted for and all of that. You want to make
absolutely
sure. Okay. Yeah.
All of that's in our numbers. And yeah. And Joel has advised us too. We'll tell him, we know this is a property we're buying, and he'll, you know, it had AC, the window units. And he said, well, if you put central AC, your insurance is going to drop significantly, and that's going to increase our cash flow. And now we're refinancing it. So it's not money out of our pocket anyway. So those little tips have helped us a lot along the way. A new roof is going to help your insurance go down. So those are all things that you can do from the very beginning. You know, so yes, when we look at a property, we're looking at it like it's going to need all of this. And we're pretty conservative with our numbers, with our rehab numbers.
Yeah, for anyone that's not familiar with the Burr strategy, it's worth learning if you like the idea of buy and hold, because it's the way to do it without much of your own capital. And it's really the magic that's allowed us to grow. I mean, it took a lot of work, but without understanding those formulas of buying, like at a flipper's numbers, you know, 75% ARV minus repairs, somewhere in there. And then creating equity, I always tell people, the simple way to think about a Burr property is you're creating equity instead of paying for equity. So you're creating this equity that you could have sold and made in one lump sum as a flip, or you can just keep it rolling, and that becomes the equity that's your down payment, if you will, into this newly rehab property that hopefully is minimally maintenance intensive for the next several years, because you fix it up nicely and you know it from top to bottom. So it's really been awesome for the growth of our business.
Yeah, and I would like to add to that, that again, we want to attract good tenants. We want to attract as many people as possible into our property so we can be selective. And so we have to provide a good product in order to do that. But I will say that I do a lot of research on the area, because you can over-improve a property and not get any return on that too. So we're very selective on what we do. And then also the areas of San Antonio change very much. You know, some things are popular in one area. So it's not what I like, it's what that area likes, because again, I'm selling a product. I'm not gonna go live in the house. So, you know, there's the areas of San Antonio change, and it's being familiar with something that's gonna do well at Southtown is not going to do good at the Great Northwest. You know, it's just doesn't work that way. So it's knowing your areas of town to be able to sell your property. I mean, rent your property to us, you know, it's still sales. We're still, you know, providing a property to the tenant. So it's doing a lot of research. So I manage all the projects. So I look a lot of pictures on the rentals, the area, and then work all the numbers, you know. But yeah, we try to factor everything in before we make that offer.
I love how you consult with your team, and consulting with Joe on what ways, because those are very creative ways of saving more money, especially on your insurance. That if you're debating on whether doing a roof, well, it's going to help your insurance price. So that's very, very important. And I think all those numbers play a huge factor in cash flow and loan to value. I mean, everything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We did have a question from Chris Ramirez. She asked, do you have a max amount of rehab that you're willing to do on your rentals?
We'll do anything. We started out the first house, Jonathan, you've heard this story, but we bought this house and it was like every penny we had to buy it. And we had like $1,000 for a rehab, and it was literally like paint, carpet, and a couple of baseboards. And we thought we should be on HGTV because we were doing this massive rehab. Like, and we were scared to death because we didn't have any more money. So it had to work. And yeah, we were pretty sure we were Chip and Joanna Gaines at that point in time. But HGTV never called. So
we're still waiting.
Yeah. So, but then we've gotten into foundations. I mean, piers throughout the house, piles of mud in the house, you know, and friends are calling and saying, do you need a good lawyer? You know, somebody sold you this house with foundation damage, and no, we knew it had foundation damage. It was priced in. So our confidence has gone up, but Veronica's a little more risk tolerant than I am. So there are these houses where we go in and I look and I'm like, oh, no way, no way. And she looks, she's like, I just love it. So we temper each other a little bit there.
Which is good.
Yeah, but yeah. We've done foundations down to the studs. We've never done any massive addition of square footage, which is a strategy some people use. You know, we haven't added a lot of square footage, but we've done pretty massive rehabs. So I think, I wouldn't advise starting with a major rehab. I would start with something that's a little more cosmetic and build up your confidence and then grow from there. And that's kind of how we did it, just over time.
Yeah, I'm sure also for you guys, dealing with contractors and everything along with the rehab, I mean, it's a process in and of itself. And when you have these massive, you know, foundation to roof rehabs, it's so many moving parts. It can get so complicated. So that's why that's when you send out Veronica out there to just put everybody in line and make sure everybody's
John,
delivering.
Dude, I can't tell you how many times. She's straightening people up. I'm talking people, grown men, and she's straightened them out on the job site. But she's really great at project management. And we always thought, I mean, logically, we thought maybe because I knew about construction and, you know, that I would manage projects, but that's not my forte. She's really good at project management, and she has learned about construction to do project management on construction sites.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about construction. It was really overwhelming at first. And I just, and but we realized that we're not the ones out there, you know, actually doing the work. It was more project management. That's something I had a lot of experience with coming from school administration. I was handling massive projects, and I love logistics and puzzles and putting it all together and then seeing the final product. So I really enjoy that process. So, but I had to learn the construction part of it, not that I know a lot about construction still, but I had to learn how to speak that language, I guess. And so so at first, you know, I didn't know even how to analyze a property. So I would take the contractor with me, and then I would learn, and I, you know, and then I would get a bid, and then I would go get another bid, and then I would have them put it all in detail, you know, because I would pretend like I knew what they were talking about, but then I would go and YouTube it and Google it and what is, you know, whatever they were, it is that we're talking about, and how many hours of work, and why is this guy going to charge $10,000 for it, and this guy's going to charge $1,500 for it, you know, and really how many hours worth of work is it? And so analyzing all of that, so it was a lot of learning. I'm still learning, you know, and so, and just got my best, just been lucky. And then for me, it's building, again, relationships. So now we have a great group of people. We have an awesome electrician, awesome plumber, awesome, you know, AC, all the trades. So that also helps our business be passive. So now the tenants call them directly. I mean, that's what kind of relationship we have. And so they don't call me, they call them, and we have a process, and then they just know to send me the invoice, and I just pay them on bill pay and, you know, for any repairs that come up. So it's all on autopilot. But it's building, having that trust. And then, but the moment they lie to me, or the moment, you know, they're gone and they know it, and now they lost a good customer, you know, and but there's plenty more to choose from. So we just keep on rolling.
I mean, I think what you guys, why it is that you guys are successful is that you became students of this trade, right? And that's where I see a lot of people fail, is that they get into this and from the get, they're not making anything, and they already think they're too good for a lot of stuff. You know, like, oh, I'm not gonna be spending my time doing that. That's not why I did this. Like, you're nobody. Like, you have nothing. Where does this ego come from? You know, you gotta put in the work, dude. Like, show up. And you can tell every time when somebody's failing at their business. Like, they're just, they have an ego about it, or they think that they shouldn't be doing certain things, and it just never goes anywhere. Mm-hmm. But we did have a question from Jim Morales that he says, do you put aside a maintenance budget for the systems that might fail, like plumbing, AC, things that can crush your cash flow?
That's a good question. We don't separate them by property, but we have a reserve account. And what we have found is when you have one house and the AC breaks, it can be pretty catastrophic. But as you have several houses, the cash flow from other houses can help pay for that AC on that house. So we don't have a very scientific number to tell you of this percentage to set aside. But definitely one thing we see new landlord or buy and hold investors do is they say, my principal interest, taxes, insurance is $1,000. And my rent's $1,300, so I'm profiting $300. I'm going to go spend it on something. And that's not the case. You have to know, and people argue what the number is, that there's going to be vacancy expense, there's going to be repairs and maintenance, and then capital expenses for those ACs that have to be replaced. Again, with those tenants that stay with you for years and years, that vacancy expense gets very, very small. And that's one thing we've really minimized. We have tenants that have been with us probably 5 years or 6 years straight. And one of the families, their past tenancy was for 20 years. So they're not looking to buy. Not everybody wants to buy a home. They're happy where they are. So building that or minimizing vacancy expense was important. I think when you're starting out, you can't have too much set aside. I mean, it's great to have reserves, but at some point you look at that money and you say, well, that's sitting idle. I could be making a return if I put it into something else. So what we found in learning this business is the cash flow, the cash goes up and the cash goes down, and you're constantly kind of tweaking. And coming from non-entrepreneurial worlds in education and public service in the fire department, we weren't taught that. I mean, we studied it in school, but now it's a reality. So you look, you're watching those cash flows, and you're trying to, you know, get the best return, but also keep some dry powder for times like now when a black swan event happens and everything's up in the air. Now, we had a lot of plans that we were going to do this summer with reallocating money, and now all these lenders have dried up and pulled out of the market, and everything's changed, right? So having some dry powder or some capital on the side is definitely a good bit of insurance for times like these.
Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense. John Barr wants to know if you would tell the story about the 300-pound granite contract that Veronica put in place.
Oh, man, that guy, if he's 300 pounds now, he went on a diet, because I swear he was 350 easy. I'll tell it real quick. So it goes something like this. The guy wants payment for the granite job that he's been late on for like 3 weeks overdue. This is a house we're selling. And, you know, it's run its course as a rental. It's our first rental, actually, my old bachelor pad. He's just got the backsplash to do, and he's saying, all right, just pay me. I'll come back and finish it this afternoon. And she says, no, sir. And you can't tell right here, but she's not a very tall person. And this guy was huge. And he lifts granite for a living. The guy is a massive mountain of a man. And I hear her saying, no, you're going to have to come back and finish it before you get payment. I have a contract right here that says you will receive the first half, and the second half is when it's all done. And I'm standing behind her thinking, golly, what's going to happen if this guy snaps?
How can you do this to me? How can you... what are you talking about? How can you do this to me? You're costing me money. You're lucky I'm not charging you for how much money you're costing
me. And she's pointing up at him the whole time. And he turns his truck around, peels out, and comes back and finishes the job that day. So she held her ground despite the physically intimidating nature of the guy, and he was being verbally. And, you know, the shame of it is that guy lost so many granite jobs since then that we would have hired him on. We found a better granite person. And, you know, I think that's so short-sighted, and we've all commiserated about the contractor woes, but when you find a good one, you take care of them. And when you find a bad one, get rid of them as quick as possible, because we're doing volume and they should see that we're return customers. We're not a once every 20 year granite person. We're a 5 granite, 6 granite jobs a year person, you know?
I mean, that's something that we're not going to get into in this podcast, because I'm going to start using a lot of colorful language and it'll drag on for hours. But the rehab side, man, it's definitely something else. And contractors, a lot of them, they're good at doing the job. They just do not understand how to run a business. They don't understand the business side of it. And I think that's really where they struggle and where it causes so much problems for us. But moving on, actually, Joel had asked the question for me, which was my next question. He says, when you get to the management portion, can you speak on the tools you use? Is it just QuickBooks or something additional? So that was pretty much my question, was when you're finished with the rehab, you know, you're getting ready to rent. First of all, do you start marketing while you're rehabbing? Do you wait until you refinance? Like, what's the process when you start marketing for your rentals?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I tried that. I tried listing it before it was done. And I don't do that anymore. So I want the house to be completely ready to go, because what I want is to spend as little time as possible showing this property to maximize my time. Again, I want to structure it towards as passive as possible. So I wait till it's absolutely ready to shine and be shown. So I might list it, I'll list it for, like, let's say on a Thursday or Friday, I'll have it go live on Zillow, and then Zillow goes to multiple platforms. And then from there, I wait a whole, I let it just sit for a week, and I'll answer all the calls, and I'll answer all the messages or emails. And I schedule them all for the following Saturday at 10:30 in the morning, every single one of them, because what I've learned is about 50% of them show up of all the people that I scheduled for whatever reason. I don't know, but it just happens every time. So 50% of the people show up. So now I have hopefully multiple cars there at our property. And a lot of times we make it a family event. Our kids go and everything. And then we just open the door, and now it's a scarcity mindset. So it's worked for us, and that way we're not spending a lot of time showing this property. We wait till it's completely done. Then I have it go live. I get great pictures. My sister's a photographer, and so I actually have professional pictures to sell it. I do all of that up front, have the property ready to go, move in ready, and then we go ahead and market and just spend one Saturday morning. Hopefully, that's all it takes so we can get it rented, and we're not spending our entire life getting this property rented.
Tools.
So we use Zillow for that, and then for screening, it depends. Sometimes we have out-of-state applicants, so they'll just apply straight through Zillow. Before, on my own, I just Googled it, and I found eRenter, and eRenter has worked well for us as far as screening tenants. We use QuickBooks as far as all of the management, and we invoice all of our tenants, so it's all automatic, and they pay directly to QuickBooks, and then so all that's done automatically. I just check that the deposits were made. the QuickBook lets me know when they paid, and that's always a fun time when I get all those little things on my phone, that rent's being paid. That's always a fun time. So those are tools. I don't know how, like, actual software or management tools, but as far as property management, the whole, I don't know how much time we have as far as all the steps and everything. But I will say that all the work up front in the marketing and the screening and getting the right person into the property is what makes rentals passive. And if you do all that work up front, once you get the right person in there, now it's autopilot, and that's how we're able to make those long-term rentals as passive as possible.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. So you guys don't rush to the first person that says, yeah, I'll pay full rent. You really want to vet the applicant and all that to make sure that you're not going to have much trouble moving forward with them, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, so we thoroughly screen them.
Yeah, that's really good point. When you're buying the property, so you implement the BRRRR strategy. So when you're buying them, I guess probably we should have done this one first. what type of funding do you use? Do you use like hard money, private money? Do you use your own money and then refinance? Like, how does that process look?
So we use private money exclusively. We've built some good relationships with people, and I think that starting out, I would definitely recommend looking into private money. We're not against hard money, but typically the rates are a little higher with points, draw fees, et cetera. And our private lenders are much more relaxed. They're not professional lenders. They're professional something else, right? They have a job and they want to get a better return. So the cool thing about the BRRRR process is you're using their money for a short amount of time, maybe 6-7 months, and a high interest rate. They get their money back, and the first thing they say is, do you have another deal for me? They want to loan to you again. And so those private money relationships have been gold to our business. And they're people who have inquired with us a lot of times. We will be talking about what we're doing, and hey, I'm interested in that. I've got some money, and they've actually kind of come to us in some cases. So that's been awesome. So private money exclusively, and we just have a handful of lenders that we use that we go back to over and over. And what we find is they're really investing in us more than they are in the property, in our character, in the fact that we're going to pay them before we pay anything. As I always put it, we're going to be eating rice and beans and ramen noodles before we don't pay a private lender. They're the backbone of this business. So for us, it's not even about the deal. If that deal goes bad, the lender still gets their money. It would have to be catastrophic for them not to get paid. And then when you treat your lenders that way, they come back and they want to lend again. And even through this time, this COVID, Veronica talks about a lot is relationships. We've emailed them, we've called them, we've told them where we are with our business, how important protecting their money is. And so we're waiting, you know, they want to get their money to work again. And we're telling them we're going to put it to work when we can, but we're not going to make a haphazard investment just to get your money to work, because return of the investment is more important than return on the investment. You got to get your money back and then worry about interest. If you're not getting your money back because you're the people you're investing with aren't making good decisions, that's not going to build a very good relationship. So private money through friends, and don't, if you're trying to build private money relationships, my one bit of advice is don't ever assume you know who has money and who doesn't. There's a lot of people that drive, you know, questionable cars and don't dress too nice that have more money than, you know, anything you can imagine. And they're not showy. They don't look like rich people. If you've ever read The Millionaire Next Door, it's those people. And they're savvy and they know how to make their money work. So if you haven't read The Millionaire Next Door, it's a great book. But they look like the rest of us, but they've got some money they want to put to work. And you give them that return and they're going to want more. So that's my long answer to a short question.
No.
And I don't think I answered you, John. You asked if we wait till they're refinanced before we rent it out. Most lenders require a 12-month lease. So we wait till we have that lease in place before we refinance it. And we always guarantee our lenders a minimum of 3 months worth of interest. So usually that's about the time we're refinancing. But that's about how long it takes before, you know, you rehab the property and get it all ready to go and everything. So
most of your conventional lenders are going to want a 6-month seasoning period anyway. So,
true, yeah.
So we'll have a term on the loan for, say, a year, and we'll let them know we're probably going to refi you at 6 or 7 months, but we're going to guarantee you at least 3 months of interest. And that has come into play because you want it to be worth their while. The house she talked about earlier that was, we thought would rent for $1,400 and no one was applying, we ended up selling it. So we sold it in a short amount of time, but we still paid 3 months of interest to make it worth our lender's time and effort of entrusting us with their money. So they're going to get at least 3 months of interest and up to a year sometimes. So
yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And when you're borrowing the money initially, are you borrowing purchase rehab up to like that 80% so you can refinance? I mean, how much do you borrow?
Great question. So early on, we borrowed less because of our confidence wasn't that high. We didn't have that much of a track record. So we bought a house at, say, $75,000. And let's say that was a 75% minus ARV minus repairs deal. And we actually borrowed 70. So we borrowed less than purchase. And we funded the renovations out of our own pocket and savings and probably credit to get the renovations done. But we wanted that lender to have a very low loan to value so they would feel very safe. But our confidence and their confidence increased. The next time, the very next property we asked for purchase and renovation, they paid the whole thing, no questions asked, never saw the property, wired the money to the bank, got paid off, and they've been one of our number one lenders ever since. You know, every time we get a deal, they get first dibs because they have bet on us from the beginning when we weren't a sure bet, you know, when things were more sketchy. And so we definitely try to take care of them.
That's a really good point. And it's so important to take care of relationships, especially with your private money lenders, with your even your traditional money lenders and with everybody. It's all relationships. That's all this business runs on. And that's why we see a lot of investors right now that are struggling because they never took the time to build relationships. They were just so transactional. Right. So now that they need relationships because people don't trust them, they don't have any of it, you know? So it makes it so much harder for them to adapt.
You know, that's a great point, John. One of the things that we talk about when we talk to a wholesaler that's selling a property, a lot of times we're offering less than their price. You know, we get the email, it's 90,000, and we'll take the time to look and we'll tell them, we'll always make an offer. But I always tell them, I'm more interested in a long relationship with you than this one deal. So I'm not going to, you know, back and forth, used car salesman. I'm going to tell them, here's our best price, and we really appreciate the opportunity. But, you know, we don't mean to offend you with our price. This is just our best, highest and best price. But we want to do more business with you. We want to do more than one deal. So if this one doesn't work and you sell it to someone else, great. Maybe the next one will work. And really try to build that relationship. And in multiple occasions, we've bought multiple houses from the same wholesaler because of that relationship.
It matters so much. I mean, our whole business, we started off as wholesalers. The only reason we're still in business is our relationships. I mean, and it's something that I try to stress to a lot of wholesalers. It's don't focus on the money, focus on the relationships, because now is, you know, we were talking about it before the call, like how has the crisis affected us? And it hasn't, you know, we have great money lenders, we have great deal source, we have everybody that we're still fine. We haven't felt, thank God, we haven't felt anything, you know, and it's all the relationships. It's not because we're geniuses, it's because we have the right people around us. So, I mean, that's an excellent point. So moving along here, your management style, I'm curious about that. How do you manage, you have your tenant, you refinance, they're in the place. How do you manage them moving forward? Do you do inspections? Do you like follow up with them every so often to see how they're doing? You send them filters for the AC units? I mean, like what's your management style? In a nutshell, I'm sure we can get into a whole call on management alone, but in a nutshell, what's your style?
Yeah, property management's an art in itself, I think. There's so much to it and so many different ways to do it. What has worked for us is again, those relationships, building good, solid rapport with our tenants. So so at first, it's the screening, the thorough screening. So, you know, we don't want anybody with like a serious criminal background. A lot of our tenants might have credit issues. We just request a higher deposit. So it's just getting the right person into the property. Once we select the person into the property, we treat it customer service. So we tell them when it's moving day. Our property is Home Again Properties. We pride ourselves in creating this house into a home again, we take it very seriously. And we say their home. You know, we call it your home and your house, and we want them to take pride in the space that they're living in. And that's the upside. And I really, there's a lot of a part of an education that I miss. And so I really enjoy being able to provide a good property that I'm proud of to this family. And so we'll sit, and then it's clear expectations. I mean, I go through the contract and I don't assume anything. You know, I use the Trek contract and I go word for, you know, section by section. And then I give them I give them the 12 filters for the AC for the year, and I show them how to change it out. I show them where the breaker box is. I tell them that I have 9 to 5 office hours Monday through Friday, so to please contact me during that time. This is all written out, and so I'm going over all of it. And I said only if it's an emergency, you know, you can contact me on the weekends. And then I tell them what an emergency is. So it's setting those clear expectations. One thing that has helped a lot is that they contact the whatever trade it is, whatever contractor it is, they contact them directly now. So that's helped a lot with the repairs. And then I just get the invoice in the mail. And then I just pay through bill pay. So I never have to meet a contractor or anything anymore. it's just setting those systems in place. We do walkthroughs once a year. And at first I felt weird. It was like an inspection on my house. So now I take the approach of I want to make sure the property is up to code. So I walk through the property, check that the smoke detectors are still working. And so it's less invasive. And it's great. Like at first I dreaded. I'm like, oh, I have to go and schedule this property. You know, but then I go and they're offering me a cup of coffee. They're asking about the kids. And it's just great. It's a great time to build rapport, keep those relationships. And I feel like that's really has paid off during this time with COVID. I mean, you know, when we found out that we couldn't evict tenants, and I was like, oh my gosh, I felt like that was the biggest tool we had. And like, why would they continue paying if we can't evict them? But I really feel like they were emailing us and checking on us, how we were doing. I mean, that's how strong these relationships are. You know, and they all came through, and I really feel that putting that time in and treating them with respect, and then also customer service. If they need a repair, we try our best to have it done within 24 hours. So we go above and beyond. In education, we call it making deposits into their emotional bank account. So that goes into any, and the reason I say that, all those deposits have to be made because I am a stickler for the contract. So I do not budge at all on the contract. So if they're late, they're gonna pay late fees. I mean, I just go we really go by the contract. And so because we've built this great relationship and made all these deposits into their emotional bank account, when it comes down to it, it's okay to make those withdrawals and sticking to those contracts. So that has really paid off. And so that's our management style. We go above and beyond with customer service, but we do not budge when it comes to those contracts. And it's having those professional relationships. These are not the relationships where they're coming to our kids' birthday parties. These are good, solid, professional relationships. We're going up on rent every year, you know, because we have to keep up at least with inflation. You know, if your property taxes are going up, insurance is going up. So, you know, you have to have the type of relationship where you can go up on rent every year on your tenant, you know, and that's a fine balance, but you have to stay in business. So, I would say our management style is very building that rapport and relationship, but we're going to stick to that contract and treat it like a business.
I have so many more questions right now, but I think we're going to make this interview like 3 hours long if I expand on those. I mean, such great, great information on all of that. That was really good. Now, when COVID hit, how did you handle this, that crisis? So COVID hits, you know, you're finding out, just like all of us did, that evictions are no longer allowed, pretty much, that they can, you know, not pay rent and everything was going to be okay for them. What did you do? How did you react to this as far as, you know, reaching out to your tenants, or what did you guys do to adjust? I mean, how did that affect you?
Well, we were prepared for the worst, and we had heard some advice, you know, communicate. But we opted to wait on a case-by-case basis to see who was struggling. We obviously didn't want to reach out and say, hey, you don't have to pay the rent this month, because we have a mortgage to pay on these properties. So we did have a couple of people reach out. Surprisingly, one of them was still fully employed and was asking if she still had to pay the rent. And we said, well, did you lose your job? And she said, no. And so, well, you still have to pay your rent, you know. And unfortunately, that is the rarity. You know, most of our tenants wouldn't take that approach. And I think that most of them know that, just like they are, you know, we have a business to run and we have bills to pay. So we had one family that had to reduce the amount they could pay on in the April's rent, and they paid half a month's rent. May, they paid half a month's rent. And all the rest of the tenants paid in full, which I think is amazing. But Veronica's communicated some of the programs that are available to them to help them out. And we really would love for that family that's struggling, if they can get back on their feet, to stay with us. We feel a loyalty to them, and we would like to help them catch up and get back on track if at all possible. And if they reach the point that they just know it's not, then we'll transition to them moving out. But we're not going to penalize them. They weren't doing anything wrong when this happened. They were great tenants, and an unfortunate circumstance happened to them, really.
Yeah, I think we made the decision because we had heard a lot of people were advising to contact them before rent was due. And I said, well, the mortgages aren't contacting us whether we're going to be able to pay or not. You know, I think it's kind of a wait and see, because I didn't want to open that door. I wanted them to, I didn't want to open that door until rent was late, right? And then I was going to reach out to them. So we had made the decision. So the conversations were hard, you know, when somebody's lost their job and it's not their fault. And but it was, we had to explain to them, we have a mortgage on this house. So if you don't pay rent, we both lose this house, you know. And so that was the message. But these are the programs available. This is who's hiring. And let's see, how much can you pay? Well, I can pay half. Okay. So then the other half, we're going to do a payment plan, and, you know, it's just that constant communication. But it's just been that we were lucky that it was just the one family that is really struggling. But it was just, you know, it's still having to come through treat it like a business. We're going to work with them. It's an unfortunate situation. But we also can't keep somebody if they're unemployed. You know, we just won't be able to keep the house. I will say that when COVID hit, like, that was scary when I heard that we couldn't evict them. I felt like it was like, you know, as a parent, like, you can't, you know, like, what do you do? What do you have left? And then it was just so nice to see how they all came through and paid. And then, you know, for a while I started kind of second guessing our business as far as really how passive is it, because up until COVID, I mean, we were growing our portfolio like crazy. So I was managing, you know, all the rehabs and then the property management and everything. And it was like, is this really passive, you know? And but when COVID hit, it was like, wow, this really is passive. I mean, we got paid, like, and we don't have a project going on right now. So it was like, oh my gosh, my birthday was yesterday. So I'm 42 now, but it was
happy
like,
birthday.
I can sit on my, thank you. But you know, I sat on my back porch, drank my cup of coffee. I could read a book. I could be there for the kids to help them with their distance learning. And we still got paid, you know? And it was like, this is really awesome. Like, this could really be passive if we weren't in such a growth phase. And then the other thing that gave us peace of mind is that we're in a good, strong equity position. So if they didn't pay, we could sell the property at a discount if we absolutely had to, you know, because we are in a really strong equity position in all of our properties. So that's also reassuring. We can sleep at night knowing that if we had to, we could sell it and then, you know, come out clean.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that answer, back to the why we like buy and hold in single family or small multifamily, if our whole portfolio was in one apartment building, we couldn't sell one unit. But because they're individual properties, in a worst case scenario, we could piece out the portfolio and sell things. And you know, when you run a business, you have to think about what is the worst case scenario. We've talked about it before, John. I've been hungry before. I can start over. We'll come back. We're not people that roll over, but you do think about what's the worst case. And with that equity position, you can sell one off. Now, if we only had one rental and it was this tenant that was struggling, it would probably be very stressful, in some ways more stressful than having several rentals, because the cash flow from those other ones helps keep this one afloat. We feel more able to help the one that's struggling. We use the word eviction several times. And just to be clear, eviction is your leverage. But in our whole experience in this career, this profession, this business, we have yet to evict anyone, knock on wood. And I think part of that comes back to relationships. We've had people that have had unfortunate events and we found a mutually agreeable way for them to move on, but we have not had to evict anyone. I'm grateful for that. But Veronica, when she used that term, I think that's the legal leverage that you have, you know, if you have to utilize it. And we've just been fortunate, but I think it's largely because of the front end work that Veronica does that we haven't had to use that tool ever to this point.
And it's like all of us, right? When we get into this business, I mean, I would say the majority of us are not getting into it so we can go evicting our tenants, right? Like, not a good process. It's not fun. But, you know, it's not something that anybody wants to do. Like, last thing we want is to evict a tenant. We want them to be able to be there and be happy and afford it. And everything is great, right? Like, we don't want any problems. That's right. The whole point of buying rentals. So I completely agree. And moving forward with this, what are your guys' plans? Have you guys sat down to maybe reevaluate ever since the COVID happened, if your plans have shifted, changed as to how your investments are going to look in the future? What's that look like?
Well, from my perspective, we're going to probably hoard a little more cash or hold on to a little more cash than we normally would. Like I was saying earlier, there gets a point where you have some cash and you think, well, I need to deploy this and get a better ROI. But I think we're playing a little more defense, so we're probably going to hold on to a little more cash, be more selective on deals. And because so many of the lenders that we were using, when you run out of conventional loans, you have to go to a secondary market of some sort for the long-term money. So our private loans are generally short. And while those lenders would love to lend long-term, the rate's still gonna be a rate that's so high that it's gonna be hard to cash flow unless you just get a heck of a deal. So until we have more of the lenders coming back in the market, it's harder to make a buy and hold work. So I think we're gonna hold on to some capital, see where lending goes, see where prices go, and then when it's time, we'll move aggressively. I just don't think we have seen the opportunities yet. You know, to mitigate some of the risk of investing in this market, the prices are going to have to be lower than they would have been. The two offers I've made so far during COVID, again, through our network or referrals, they were lower than they would have been 2 months ago because the types of financing that is available to us is different now, and the uncertainty of the market is different. But we're not giving up on real estate by any means. We're just kind of taking in the information as it comes. But if a good deal comes along, we're jumping on it. We're definitely still in buying mode. We haven't reached our goals. You know, every time we have a goal and we get there, we expand the goal and go for the next one. So, which makes it fun. So we're just kind of seeing what the landscape offers us and preparing for the next opportunity, I think.
Earlier, John Barr had asked, what are your guys' ultimate end goal with real estate?
That's a good question too. Well, you know, one of our goals was met by Veronica being able to stay home and be more present with our kids and our family and me. I work 24 hour shifts, and when I was working 24 hour shifts and overtime and she's working, you know, these long hours, we just didn't have much of a family life. So we have that back, and that was the biggest goal to me. You know, we travel, we camp, we do a lot of outdoor stuff, ride horses. And so the lifestyle, we've already accomplished the lifestyle we were after and loving this life. I think in the long run, we'll probably get to 30 houses. Our original goal was 10 houses before I was going to retire. We had about 20 years to get to 10 houses. And we met that a lot quicker than we had planned. And then we expanded our goal to 30 houses. And
how many do you have now?
We have 18 right now. So we're looking at 30, and I have a feeling we'll get there and we'll reassess. But our next step might be to hire a part-time assistant to help with some of the day-to-day tasks so that we can focus more on growing, because with me having a full-time job and Veronica being so busy when we do have a project to manage, plus the you know, the property management, we need, it would help to get some of that off of our plate so that we can focus on growing and use our time as, you know, more efficiently. But I would say 30 properties would be the next benchmark. But I have a feeling, knowing Veronica, we'll get there, and then we'll grow the goal again. But it's just too much fun. I mean, why would you stop if you're having fun and enjoying it and enjoying the business? And we really like teaching and sharing this information because, you know, we just think it's life-changing. It has literally been life-changing for us. And we want to share that with people. So even if we hit our 30 and decide we don't want more property, I don't think we'll stop teaching it, because it's like, gosh, if more people could learn this earlier, younger, and take action on it, I think it could change lives.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I completely agree. I mean, this is why we even do this, right? It's all free. It's all just free education, because it's just, we believe in it that much, and we believe people should have the right information available to them so they can take advantage of these. So we have one more, more technical question before we wrap up with our finishers. And this is John Barr again. He says, since you're a realtor, do you ever try to work with your tenants to move up to owning their own home and represent them in that transaction?
That's a really good question. So we have tenants that have expressed interest in buying. And so we've always told them, if that is the case, let us know, and I'll be happy to represent you, and you don't have to stay the 12 months or whatever, we can let you off the lease, you know, and we've done that, but that hasn't happened. But I did have one where it was an applicant for our new rental, and when I went to do the background check, I realized there were homeowners, and I was like, what's going on? And so anyway, they needed a realtor to list their property, a really nice house. So they were downsizing, and so it was a listing. So it was great to utilize my license in that instance. So now they're a tenant, and, you know, I sold their house. But I haven't used it yet. I've had tenants say they want to move. It just hasn't happened, which is fine. But so I haven't used it in that capacity, but it has come in handy on the backside, which was interesting.
All right. Very good. Yeah, because we actually had a deal. One of our tenants was looking to upgrade and buy their own home. And John, he's like, well, I can represent you in that, you know. And they were buying a higher-end home and everything. So it's like, why not, right? I mean, you're already there. You have great rapport with them. And you can control their transition and bring the new tenant in. So, I mean, it worked out great for us in many different ways. And so this is actually ties into one of my questions, and it's from Marcella Dominguez. She has, so you mentioned that you haven't bought in a bit. As someone looking to get started, what advice would you give in these unsettling times? Also, biggest challenge you faced?
Wow,
that's a good one. as far as buying in these unsettling times, I think if you feel confident that you can create some equity and give yourself some cushion for a worst case scenario, also having some reserves in the bank. You know, we do a lot of transactions that are technically no money down or no money invested transactions, but that doesn't mean we don't have any money. It means that we're using the strategy, but you want to have money in the bank to pad your errors, right? How often our budget for repairs goes over. So if you hadn't over budgeted or had the reserves, that'd be really stressful and you'd probably hate this business. So we put aside reserves, and I would recommend that to a new person particularly. Have reserves and know where you have access to capital. Maybe it's a line of credit, a home equity line of credit, somewhere that you can get funds if things don't go quite as planned, because they won't go as planned. Something will come up. So have contingencies in place, have multiple exit strategies. So most of our portfolio would have sold. We could have sold at the outcome as a flip. We could have turned into a rental. We could have owner financed, and most of them would have worked as Airbnbs when Airbnbs were still being booked. So having multiple exit strategies, I think, is key. I think if you go into something and it only works as a flip, that's a lot more stressful. And a lot of these high-end flips, I think, they only work as flips probably, unless you can, like you said, feed something a negative cash flow deal. So I would look for something that could work as either thing, Marcella. If you see that you could sell it in a worst case scenario and break even, you know, as the market's dropping and you just had to sell it for what you had in it, that would be, you would have gotten an education. Best case scenario is you keep it as a rental for a lot of years and then you do another one down the road, you know. Just getting that first one done, though, and having some reserves so that it's a success will build your confidence for the next one. And what was the second part of that?
The most challenging?
Oh, the biggest challenge. Do you have a...
Biggest challenge. That's a hard one. So I would say for me, it was just going into this whole new world, just the learning curve. And like for me, it was construction. Just by Marcela, she built her own house. So she's Miss Construction. She's amazing. So she would do really well. I think one thing I learned during COVID was I've always known that I'm super competitive, really. And so being able to enjoy the process. So while it's fun and I've learned this from Will, is really enjoy it, you know? And so I go to a lot of networking events and it's like, okay, what project? And, you know, why don't I have a project going on? And then it's like, I get all, you know, worked up and I'm like, let's go. And then I walk out of there and it's like, I have to have all these deals. So it's learning, I guess during COVID, I've learned that I need to just, you know, learning to enjoy this whole process, because there is a lot to learn. I mean, we're, you know, like, all, you know, multiple properties in and managing now for several years. And I learned something from every single transaction. So, you know, there's a lot to learn. And so it's just enjoying the whole process, I guess, is something I've learned lately through this whole COVID.
Yeah. So being that you're competitive, let's see who gets 30 properties first.
Exactly.
You're hearing, John? Come on, we gotta beat them. just to wrap up, last question: what is some books maybe that you guys can recommend that have had the biggest impact on your life, whether it's personal or business or both? Like, what are these books that you're like, you gotta read these ones?
Oh, I've got a list.
I'll tell you the most recent that makes me think of you, you guys, John, is The Go Giver. Have you ever read The Go Giver?
No.
It's a really short, like, one day book, but it's about kind of what you guys do and just sharing what you've learned with people. Mm-hmm. And good things happen is what, that's the 20 second synopsis. Go Giver. It's a really motivating, positive book. I really like that recently. For personal finance, I tell everyone that doesn't know where to start, like I didn't know where to start. No one teaches us in school about money. It's just the Dave Ramsey Total Money Makeover. We use a lot of debt in our business, but we don't in our personal life. So he wouldn't agree with our business practices, but he would be proud of our personal budget, I guess. So if you don't know where to start, that's a good place to start making sense of things. Of course, Rich Dad, Poor Dad is like, the, you know, everybody mentions that book, and it is, that's a mind shift, and it's very different than Dave Ramsey, but I think that's a good one when you start thinking entrepreneurially. Rich Dad Poor Dad is a great book. Another book, not so well written grammatically and so forth, is Life and Air, like Millionaire, but Life and Air, and it talks about kind of building the life you want and not just getting overtaken with more and more and more. You know, we're not really the Grant Cardone type that we want a personal jet and all this. We want a lifestyle that we enjoy. And so I strongly recommend that one. Do you have some?
Property management, I found the Bigger Pockets. I don't know the title. It's by Brandon Turner and his wife wrote it. I think it's really good. There's not a whole lot of good good books out there on property management. That one was, I wish I would have read it from the very beginning before I started. So it's just a good tool. We read Life and Error one summer, and that really helped us get our goals in line and keep us focused, because we go to all these seminars and, you know, like Will said, we went to Colorado, and it's great. Like, it's good to go to all the seminars and networking, because it's all knowledge and it's all information, and we're constantly growing, and, you know, and that's our goal, to continue to go. But it's also, it's good to remain focused. Like, why do we even do this to begin with? And so keeping our goals in mind, and, you know, and not being, getting the shiny object syndrome and getting off track. You know, we ventured into other parts, but always keeping, it always has to support our main goal, which is being able to enjoy these awesome years that we have right now with our kids and this great life that we've been blessed with.
It's funny when you said Life and Air, because I feel like if I ever wrote a book, that's exactly what the feedback would be. Like, the grammar was so off. Man, yeah, that book wasn't very well written. But like, yeah. My books are going to be kind of like just videos transcribed. But guys, thank you so much for coming on. You've shared a wealth of knowledge. We've had so many people already, you know, commented great information. They love you. You know, you guys rock. I mean, you guys are getting so much love from people. I always encourage you guys to keep sharing and helping, because I think you guys are by far one of the most honest people in the business, and actually talk from experience and from real knowledge, which is really lacking nowadays, especially when you look at social media and everything, all these Facebook famous people, and you know that they don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Right.
You know, I always try to recommend people to the people I follow, and you guys are definitely it. So if you guys want to learn more on real estate and everything, you got to follow Will and Veronica. They share everything they do. You guys have live videos. Will does some amazing songs too. He gets out with his guitar. So great information, great content all around from their lifestyle. They share all that with everybody. So I definitely recommend everybody following them and reaching out to them. They're always willing to help. I've never heard them turn anybody down. So, you know, anything you grab, reach out to them. They're always here to help. So guys, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having us, and thank you for all that you've contributed to our business over the years. You and John, both of y'all.
Thank you very much.
It's great to be part of a network of great other, you know, real knowledgeable investors that are willing to share so much. And And my last word is just, if people know something, share something, you know, especially in times like this, share something with somebody, teach somebody something. Don't hoard knowledge. It's not about competition. It's about collaboration. And it's so fun to watch your friends and peers in the business have success like you guys are having, and so many of our other friends, and bring some along with you.
Yeah. I love that, because you get back what you put out, right? And that's exactly it. And if you put out more help and resources, you get more help and resources back. So thank you guys again for coming on. I hope to have you back on, because I have a ton more questions that I've been wanting to dig into. So I would love to have you guys back again for a part two on this and expand on some areas.
Anytime. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Have a great night, and I will see you guys later. There you have it, everybody. Thank you so much for watching this week's Tips from the Pros. I hope you guys got a lot of value from this. Like I said, and you guys see all the people that we bring on is people that we personally like and will do business with. And Will and Veronica are definitely those people. They're the people that you want to partner with. They're the people you want to work with. You've heard their values. You've heard how they treat their money lenders, how they treat their partners. To them, it's always about doing what's right and not what's easy. That is usually the result from a lot of other people, is they always go for what's easy. So I definitely recommend that you guys seek them out, reach out to them, ask them for help, ask them for advice. These guys know it all. They've been doing this. It comes from experience. So I would definitely recommend you guys reach out to them and just keep watching. You know, we'll be uploading this to our podcast, so you'll have this in audio format if you want to listen to it again. I strongly recommend it, because there's a lot of stuff that they shared in here. Great value for picking up rentals. So, and just stay tuned to the next interviews that we'll be doing next week. We're actually bringing somebody on for short sales. Short sales are a big key when it comes to a market correction and everything like this. Back in 2008, some of the biggest investors that came out of it were doing short sales. So we're having that next week. So stay tuned for that. And thank you all for watching, and I'll catch you on the next one.